order. And we are going to start with House Bill 2148. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2148. Committee, I would draw your attention to the fact that we have some amendments for this that we passed out last week. It's basically a replacement of the original bill. Draw that to your attention, and also for those that are going to be speaking on this bill, you can go ahead and address those. And also, I have been working with Department of Administrative Services and with Legislative Fiscal, and there will probably be some additional amendments as well. So, with that said, Cindy Becker, let me have you go ahead and come on up. And since you're the only one I have on my list...
Is that good news or bad news?
Well, I'm not sure yet.
Depends on the list.
I think Ben was going to.
On, you know, it depends. On one hand or the other hand, you know, it's the autonomous thing. No, I'm just kidding. Go.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Becker, and I'm Assistant Director of the Department of Administrative Services. I'm here to chat just for a minute or so about the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2148. And I know that you are working with the department and I think the Legislative Fiscal Office on these. So I'm not going to comment on everything. The one area that I would like to draw your attention to is on page 6 of the Dash 1 amendment, line 4, which is item 13, sub A. If, in fact, you are seeking an ending balance that would result in a reserve, the key issue is that the legislatively adopted budget must have a reserve. Just having a report and it being in the governor's budget doesn't guarantee that that's going to happen. So we would recommend that you add a line in sub A that speaks to the legislatively adopted budget having a reserve with those monies in it.
Okay. That was one of the things we had talked about last night also.
Okay, great. The other comment I would make on page 7, section 5, sub 2, is that instead of referring to the director of DAS, that it's really the Budget and Management Division, which will be maintaining the budget control system. And again, later on in that paragraph, we would also suggest instead of director, you really refer to Budget Management, since they're the ones that are creating that.
Do you think fine to just put division in there, as a where it says you're on line 10, right after
right.
the comma?
Exactly, correct. Numbers.
So
right.
it would say the division shall instead
right.
of the.
Yeah. That would okay. be great. That would be great. It's also my understanding on page 8, section 8, that you are going to be working with DAS and LFO on making some changes in that section to get to where you want to go on that. Okay, so I'm not going to get involved with that.
Yes, we have some mechanical problems.
Yes, a few mechanical problems, but nothing significant in those areas that can't be changed. Other than that, those are my only comments, and I'll be happy to answer questions if they're very limited.
Okay, great. Are there any questions for Cindy? Okay.
Great.
Cindy, thank you very much. Let me put a couple of other things on the record while you're there. Going back to page 6 in section 4, one of the things that we had talked about was putting a timetable in this construction project management issue so that and that we would put a 2-year timetable in there as opposed to leaving that wide open. Primary reason is that if you had, for example, a 5-year project but didn't require a report for 10 years, then, of course, you would miss the project. So so putting a 2-year time frame in there, I think, is one of the things that we had discussed. And then also on page 7 in section 6, we would change the in section 6 that we would make that first paragraph there. It says, when establishing revenue management policies for the state, the Legislative Assembly and the governor shall ensure... And then we would put in there something like, or Legislative Council put in there, to the extent practicable, that, and then A, B, C, and then add what is now number 2 on line 25 as a D, so that it would be directing the legislature. And then, let's see, And then Section 8 we're working on. Also on page 8, line 3, that we would refer to future anticipated state revenues as opposed to just anticipated shortfalls in anticipated revenues. And that was pretty much it. So is that kind of your understanding also from conversations with Teresa and...
Yes, Mr. Chair, there's one other item on line 8, page 8, line 5, that you take out the word for state officers and agencies.
Correct.
Okay.
Right, yes,
great.
I missed it.
Okay. Good.
Okay, great, great.
That's it?
That's it at this point, then. Thank you very much. Ken, do you have anything to add, or... See, it's always better if the committee knows that I really am working with you and not just saying I am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. No, nothing to add, just to confirm that those are the changes we talked about and that we are working on Section 8 to resolve those mechanical problems of having general fund continuously appropriated to agencies and the mechanics of how you would get some portion of their savings due to their reduction of expenditures back to them. So we're working on that right now.
Okay. Do you have any, and I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot here, do you have any kind of an idea of when you think that might, you might have that sort of worked out, or is that just going
to
be
an ongoing? Mr. Chair, I try never to predict legislative council's workload at any time, so it's difficult to know, but we did communicate our ideas on this to them last night, so and they're of course very efficient, so I think it which should be done fairly soon, and we'll let you know as soon as we get some draft language.
Okay. Great. Are there any questions for Mr. Rocco? Okay. Ken, thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. With that, then, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2148. And what we will do, committee, is very soon, hopefully, is we will bring that back for a work session. With that, then, let me go to House Bill 3224 and open a public hearing. While Gina's bringing up the sheet, Patrick, you want to give us a little lowdown on this?
Please? Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3224 authorizes cities with more than 50,000 residents to issue non-recourse bonds to provide for retail, commercial, and industrial development. It authorizes cities to loan bond proceeds for low-income housing and other housing development. And I believe we have -1 amendments in your packets.
Yeah, that would be correct. Thank you. With that, then, let me have Linda Adlard from the City of Beaverton come on up. Good morning, and welcome to General Government. Thank you for being here this morning. And you may begin your testimony whenever you would like to.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Linda Adlard. I'm Chief of Staff of the City of Beaverton, and I appreciate you hearing this bill today. Beaverton is an unusual city. We're known for our traffic, of course. That's what most people say, decongestion. But we're actually the fifth largest city. We have a number of issues as we've doubled in 10 years on our population. We're almost 80,000 today. Excuse me. What we are struggling with today is the fact that by our charter, we do not, excuse me, I'm sorry, we do not have the opportunity to have urban renewal, nor do we have the opportunity to have a housing authority. Lots of reasons for that, but that's what our citizens have told us. So consequently, as we begin to redevelop our town, we are struggling with having tools available to us which afford our citizens a maximization of their tax dollars to the benefit of the city and to develop a downtown. We have mandates, of course, on affordable housing, on transportation, on overlays, and want to meet that. We also have the light rail that goes straight through our downtown. So the combination, and you've probably heard about our Round project, which is a mixed-use project to revitalize our downtown, or at least to begin having a downtown, actually. And we went into bankruptcy, pulled that back out. And today we're doing some very intense mixed use in our downtown, which will benefit certainly our city, but others also for the light rail usage. This is an interesting bill for Oregon cities. It allows the expansion of an existing tool to those of us who are trying to attract new businesses. We're increasing our workforce, an important factor in Washington County with the unemployment, taking some of the burden off of the state at the direction of the governor, who says, that local government needs to step up to the plate and assist with some of this commercial and industrial development. We certainly believe that we are trying to step up to that plate. Beaverton is an aggressive city. We think of ourselves as leading edge, creative, and an excellent partner when we do partner with folks. This bill specifically allows municipalities with populations greater than 50,000 to exercise powers under ORS 280-410. And the statutes that follow. It includes retail and commercial development as eligible activities, declares amelioration of adverse economic conditions as a public purpose, which is a very important thing today, and enables the use of eminent domain, which, of course, many people talk about as condemnation. Eminent domain for us is having the opportunity to condemn, not necessarily the act of condemnation, and I think that's a distinction for us. It also allows us to use revenue bonds or other available sources of funds for the activities under the statute, modernizes the statute and makes it more consistent with current bond practices, so it updates the state statute with the federal tax code. We want, because we don't have any of these other tools, such as urban renewal, it is important for a city of our size to try to have very specific tools that we use in a very serious, dedicated, and determined way to redevelop our downtown. The housing component of this certainly is important because of the mandates we have. Most downtown projects are mixed use today, which would have some commercial office, certainly some housing, and that's what we are trying to do today. So with that, I also have brought with me today Doug Goh, who is our bond counsel. This is a bit complex. And also Karen Williams, who is an attorney with Lane Powell and specializes in public projects, to answer the very technical questions if you have those.
Okay, are there any questions for Linda? Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you. My quick review of this appears to basically broaden the ability for cities that are not Portland, that are over 50,000, to be able to use the tool that they currently have, and I assume is the only city in the state that has the opportunity to use this process.
That's correct.
Follow up. The only question I have, I hadn't had a chance to look at this, is on the combination as to why is this being inserted into what would be Section 3 on page 2, starting on line 41. I was always under the impression that cities in their urban renewal could, in fact, use combination to capture land for economic development of a downtown urban area.
I believe that's correct, but we do not have, by charter, the opportunity to have an urban renewal district.
Okay.
So Beaverton is unusual. We're always a little bit different, I guess, but we do need to have specific tools in order to achieve what has been mandated, not only by the state, but certainly what is right for our citizens to be able to grow.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Linda? Linda, and I don't know if Doug or Karen want to go ahead and come forward, but one of the things that we're probably going to hear about here in a few minutes is the idea of continuation bonds, and that the state can provide those, and that Excuse me. And in a lot of respects, even the city of Portland actually utilizes this, the services of the state for such things as a continuation bonds and that sort of thing. Any comments about that?
Well, certainly. We partner with the state agency currently. We have a contract for manufactured dwelling mediation and dispute resolution, and they're an excellent agency. And certainly I think that any city ought to go to that agency first, probably, because they are the experts. And I would expect us to do that. But I also believe that if my city council was sitting here, that they would say to you that they are in charge as elected officials of what happens in Beaverton, and it is expected by our citizens that they make the decisions as to what it is that the citizens have asked them to do. Therefore, they need to have as many tools, not be restricted in their use of tools, and we believe that we're a pretty sophisticated city. Not all cities are as sophisticated, we understand that, but I do believe that administrators and city managers are smart enough to certainly direct their efforts to those who know best and to do the best for their citizens. So rather than restrict our opportunities, I think we ought to, certainly for Beaverton, add an opportunity and allow cities, because they are in charge and their citizens have the recourse of unseating them if they do not perform the way that they are expected. So certainly in our sense, we appreciate the agency. We think they're great. We certainly would look at them first. But today, with the economic decisions that we have to make for our citizens, we need every tool possible. We need the best deal possible for our citizens. And that's what we're asking for.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Adler? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jack Kinney and Bob Refine. Let me have you guys come on up. Gentlemen, whenever you're ready, go ahead and start. Welcome to General Government. Thank you for being here this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. Chair Cromwell, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Kinney, Deputy Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to speak in opposition of House Bill 3224. I appreciate the comments of the previous speaker, and we do recognize that cities in Oregon, such as Beaverton, have very competent professional staffs and are sophisticated with well-thought-out plans for community development strategies. And again, in regards to House Bill 3224, the only piece of it that we have some concerns with are the pieces relative to housing. In recent years, the legislature has expanded the authority of our department to meet the needs of Oregon cities and counties. For example, we can now issue bonds for mixed-income properties, mixed-use developments that has both for the housing components. We also have the ability to, the last legislative session greatly expanded our ability to issue conduit bonds that provide greater flexibility to cities and counties in meeting their needs. Due to the volume of our activity, we're able to maintain a staff to conduct long-term monitoring of projects, ensuring that public purposes are achieved and community standards are maintained. Our staff is also experienced, also has an experienced loan underwriting team that reduces the risk to Oregonians relative to purchasing state bonds. And our citizen-based Oregon State Housing Council provides oversight of department loan activities. Community support for a project and financial feasibility are two of the most important criteria in approving loans. We offer flexibility and responsiveness to our local government partners, and I appreciate the previous speaker's comments to that effect. And we would certainly be very happy to continue conversations with the city of Beaverton and how we can meet their needs. Our concerns relative to this bill are that with more players in the game, there's a potential for state standards relative to housing bonds to be diminished. If you will, developers could shop a number of communities and find the people that have the lowest standards. There's a limited amount of tax-exempt bond authority that the federal government grants to states. And again, as the number of players in the game increases, I think there is a greater potential for developers to shop communities that for a price, because there is a fee associated with allowing the use of this tax exempt bond authority, for a price they will have to give the least in terms of public purpose. Now, again, I wouldn't expect sophisticated cities to have that as an issue. I think they're going to be driven by what their city wants, and that would be the highest need. And again, we aren't necessarily looking for all low income. We understand that cities need workforce housing, and that's a very important purpose of this. As I said, community standards are really what's important. But our concern is that as we increase the number of players in this game, there will increase the ability for someone to shop for those that demand the least of them. Or in some cases, we've also dealt with this where different bond counsel will provide various opinions on how the tax code should be interpreted. And again, I think that's an area that there's a potential for a developer to look for someone who allows the most liberal interpretation of the tax code. And I think the beauty of using our agency is that you can maintain consistent standards statewide. Not that we're not without competition. There are housing authorities throughout the state that can issue bonds as well. So, and there's the state treasurer's arm in the Oregon Finance Authority. So, again, I believe that the economies of scale that we have from dealing with a number of housing issues allow us to maintain a strong underwriting staff with a lot of private sector experience, as well as a good asset and property management staff to review these assets, these investments that the state has made with its bond authority for the long term, for 30 years. We have people go out and look at our housing projects either every year or every 3 years, depending on the program, and maintain that long-term affordability and maintain the community standards. I think a certain volume of activity allows our department a unique ability to do that. Again, we'd be very happy to continue to work with the city of Beaverton or other cities to see if we can address our mutual concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Bob Refine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services. Just wanted to echo Mr. Kenny's comments and also applaud Linda and the city of Beaverton for, you know, really thinking aggressively and how they can improve their community using as many tools that they currently have and looking for other tool opportunities. I think the issue that we, again, this is not a control issue. It's just we as the state agency are charged with the same issues that she and her constituents are charging them as and the city council with, of making sure the right things are happening relative to both, in particularly our case, housing. And so we are just as mindful of those charges. Her constituents effectively are our constituents, and we try to work in a very cohesive way to make sure that those developments work in harmony with what the direction of a community is. So I don't find that that is anything dissimilar to each other. Actually, I think we're headed in the same direction. The issue that we get faced with, obviously, is the balance within the state. We try to be respectful of you as legislative members and the Senate members to make sure that there's an equitable distribution of wealth that goes on relative to the needs of the community at the same time. And I can tell you here sitting today that the needs always outweigh the resources that are available. And so it is that ability to try to pick at the right moment in time based on best information and the type of application that would be coming in, who should be getting the housing today versus who might be able to get it 6 months from now or a year from now. And so we try to do that in the global sense. And again, as Mr. Kenny says, I think we do that well. We're not flawless, obviously. But our record, I think, with the city of Beaverton has been a very open working relationship with Linda and her staff. We try to, on a continual basis, work with them, and as we do in all cities, to meet that housing need. And we understand the issues that they're pressed up against. But again, as Mr. Kenny stated, I think that our biggest concern is that we have seen, without going into too much detail, we have seen some bad examples of good intentions where, at the end of the day, the project that was invested on using these same type of resources was not acceptable to us, because in many cases they have to come to us for 4% tax credits to kind of put the whole deal together. And at the end of the day, those projects were, in one particular project, it was such a blatant misuse of state and federal dollars, we refused to fund it. And somebody got caught with a whole bunch of bad bonds on it or bad issuances. But that can happen. We would wish and hope that this is a good society, but unfortunately when there's opportunities out there, it always seems to bring some of the worst of people out versus always the best of people out when they're working in this field. Chairman?
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for either Jack or Bob? I'll go to our other resident lawyer here. He was back there checking the statutes. Do you have any questions for either one of these?
I don't.
Okay.
Thank you, Bob.
The one question that I guess I have is with regards to this sort of being a tool that cities could use. Do you see this as being, if the cities were able to use this themselves, and of course we're limiting it in terms of the population 50,000 or higher, which is sort of assuming that it's going to be a city that probably is a little bit more sophisticated than a real small community that doesn't have a lot of professional staff would be. But do you see this as being something that they would sort of go off on their own and utilize without necessarily talking with OHCS?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think the witness from the city of Beaverton stated, I think, twice, saying that that was not their intention. They would still counsel with us, and I would believe what she's saying. I don't think that would be the case. Again, this does open it up to approximately a greater number than just one, that it being the city of Beaverton. And so not hearing from them, I can't say how the rest of them would feel about sure. that relationship. We've always, again, had a good relationship with Beaverton, and I don't suspect that would change.
Other than Portland, I mean, we could probably count on one and a half hands. Yeah, there you go. There's one and a half or so. We could probably count on one and a half hands the number of cities that would be able to actually utilize this as a tool. Do you think that's do you think that's something Is that really problematic? I mean, from the standpoint of your professional staff and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, again, this is just more of a general characterization of the bill. I think in today's environment, particularly economically, in the case of these communities that could be eligible for this, they are all probably are if as they are the top populations of the state, they are also the top areas where much of our development takes place, mm-hmm. so they kind of go hand in hand there. One would suggest that would be the place where much of our development will take place. At the same time, we the state agency are obliged and obligated to make sure that the doofers of the state of Oregon and the drains of Oregon still have their opportunity to have housing as much as
Absolutely.
Medford or Lane County or things like this. So I think that's one of the concerns is how if let's say for the sake of argument all five or all seven of these communities got on the bandwagon and started becoming very aggressive in this marketplace, that could change dramatically the influx of affordable units, where they'll be located, how do they match up with the community needs. It's as we're trying to map or knit together the fiber of housing for the state of Oregon. Anytime these things are eligible, people are eligible to change that relationship with us, it does change the tightness of the knit.
And if I may, Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Perhaps there may be language that we could build additional safeguards, I don't know, into this bill that would perhaps address those issues.
Okay.
I suggested, Mr. Chairman, committee members, to the applicant of this bill that possibly maybe giving an authority for one community for a period of time to see how well they do and see how well they manage, where we could come back and say, this has been just a great relationship. It's given them the authority they needed, but not necessarily left the state of Oregon in the dust as far as an agency that's responsible for the housing piece. It's been a very cohesive agreement. So, I mean, there are probably solutions to the, what they're looking to attend, you know, to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Linda, let me have you come back up. I'm going to just go ahead and stay right there, Bob.
Well,
you're going to put her between us? Between
pressure. Got the pressure.
Okay, Linda, the pressure's on.
The rose.
the rose.
Got it.
Linda, how would the city of Beaverton feel about putting, and I'm going to kind of put you on the spot here, and I apologize for that, but committee, our time is growing short. You know, we've gone from, in about 24 hours, we've gone from it's being early in the session to it's now late in the session, and we've really got to get things rolling out of here. And so I don't really want to hold this up, but for the suggestion, the suggestion that Mr. Repine made with regards to utilizing this as a pilot type of project and putting that kind of language in, how would the city of Beaverton feel about that?
Mr. Chairman, certainly I'm here to represent Beaverton, and what if we are able to use this as a tool, that is my goal. But as an administrator, as a city manager, I will tell you that I do not have the doubt about professional staff coordinating with state agencies that these gentlemen seem to believe. And I don't have the experience, perhaps, with that they have with some of the others. But I think that a city will do what is best for their city and for their constituents. And if it's using the housing agency like we do, then I believe that they will do that. I have great faith in the ability of the people to direct their elected officials to do what's right. If it means that you prefer that only Beaverton be a pilot project, we're a great pilot project. We did it on photo red light, photo speed. We're happy to do that, and we will prove to everyone that indeed this is a good deal for all cities. I haven't checked with other cities. It always makes me a little uncomfortable when we sort of take a slice for ourselves. But in the end, I am here to represent my citizens and the city, and we're happy to be that. If it holds the bill up, I'm disappointed. We need to get this through just like everybody else, and this is terribly important to us, given that we have no other tools that many of the other cities do. I'm not even sure that other cities would care about using this.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Are there any questions for either one of these? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With all respect to the sponsor of this bill, I'm just curious if why this would not work for cities of 25,000 or more. I'm wondering where the number 50 came from.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Please, go ahead.
50,000 has about, there's a break in numbers of cities at 50,000. You have about 8 or 9 that are above 50,000. And then you have a whole group that are about 30, 35,000. Certainly this tool will work for any size city. But we also have to be realistic that given the economic environment and the struggles that most cities are having today, that the housing component is a difficult mandate to meet. And so we felt that those over 50,000 probably would be more likely to be able to use this as a tool for commercial and industrial development in their city. But the number is not magic at all.
Just one thought.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm concerned in that it's many of us more rural counties who really have the housing need. We certainly, as in Yamhill County, have the third most rapidly growing county, but also the third poorest from the bottom. We do have a tremendous need for low-cost housing. We are also fortunate that we draw a great new Hispanic community, and thank goodness we're just about the wine capital of Oregon and as well as the nursery capital. And, I mean, I see a tremendous need for this, and would hope that we would get support.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please.
When one looks at a statute and determines that there is an opportunity to change it and make it more contemporary to the needs of society, when it has a population figure in it, and this had 300,000, so it was only for the benefit of Portland, actually, and it was probably written many years ago when the rest of us were very small and didn't have these needs. So we chose a number just to substitute that. I'd be happy if there's no number there. It does not make a difference, certainly, to us in any means.
Chair.
Is that how you gentlemen feel, too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'll try to answer that one. Understanding your concern in the fairness of it, the problem, I think the issue is, as Linda had mentioned in her earlier testimony, some sizes of the communities bring on a certain level of specialty staff, and this business that we're talking about relative to housing is a very specialty business. This is not just something that you can do with maybe your general staff that you might have in a small community. So I think her concept of picking the 50,000 threshold, because that's used as a threshold for a variety of other characteristics for communities within the state of Oregon, is justifiable. So I don't know whether Representative Nelson, and honestly, whether or not it would work at every community level in the state. I think then you probably, our fears that we are just hypothetically talking about in the case of Beaverton, which are truly hypothetical because they are a well-greased machine, as one would call them, probably the fears of our fears would become more reality in the smaller communities around the state of Oregon, because they'll try to do it with the best interest of their community, but find themselves maybe in a very desperate situation at the end of the day.
And in what way?
Just in the financial putting this thing together. Again, if you can imagine one project that I've mentioned before, it was a multi-million dollar project. And the people who were working doing the deal were very sophisticated people. And the development came away with little or no value to the project, but went somewhere else and didn't go on the project. And so, I mean, it's subject to that. When your money is changing hands for the purpose of housing renovation rehabilitation, particularly, you know, there has to be a very close scrutinizing of how those resources are being justified and expensed. And in this case, this example, it did happen. And it turned into a very bad situation for the community.
If I might add, the city of Portland, for example, has four or five underwriting staff similar to our department. They have an asset and property management staff that goes out and monitors their projects, so they have about a half a dozen people on staff, city of Portland. They have enough volume where they can maintain a staff of, like I said, about a half a dozen property managers that go out and review the projects, make sure they're serving the population they were intended to serve, make sure they're being maintained at community standards. So there's a certain volume or economies of scale that you can get as you get to a certain size. And I think the state serves cities like county, like Yamhill County. We have that capacity statewide to meet those standards. City of Portland is large enough where they're able to have enough book of business where they're able to maintain a staff to do the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think our hesitancy on the bill is, as was stated earlier, the relationship between the threshold of 300,000 was set a long time probably before I was involved in government. And so nobody knows really what the history of that was. Our reluctancy is because we've never gone down this next venture of who might be next, because our assumption was probably in our lifetime no one would ever get to the 300,000 threshold. But you know, now we're moving the number, which I understand. Possibly a way to do it. And again, I think it's a valid. We might find at the end of the day, taking on a community, and I'm being honest here, taking on a larger community that can be shown and worked with in a collaborative way, that they can do this and our fears go away, I think that's fine. Maybe that will be one of those signals that as we do enough of these, then this agency has some other role to play for the state of Oregon and not in this financing role. That's very possible. So I understand that. But But my hesitant is to jump in with all of the cities that are at 50,000 and seeing how that tests in the water. Again, you might want to, you could raise the bar to the 80,000, which we know fits the Beaverton and really carves out some of the other larger metropolitan areas, and let us test one and see it and report back to you and see what the results were. See if it did raise issues around the, both, I mean, they're dealing with both industrial lands, but on the housing side, which we would be very mindful of, and I'm sure economic community development would be very mindful of the role that they play on the industrial, and maybe that's a partnership that we should be applauding and supporting as opposed to being fearful of. And I think the fear factor we have is just the unknowing of what it means to us because we've never been there.
Okay.
Okay, 77,000. However, they could move 3,000 people in if it makes the deal.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Gibbs?
Mr. Chair, I would just have, you know, a little apprehension with allowing Beaverton. Nothing against the great city of Beaverton. I enjoy your traffic. As I go through it to get to my city of Hillsboro. That being said, I had a great meeting with my mayor on Saturday who supports this bill and enthusiastically supports this bill. So I do support this bill, but I think at this time I would probably be shot by my mayor if I simply allowed just Beaverton. So I would have a little bit of reservations with, you know, I mean, and nothing against Beaverton. It's just that my mayor supports it.
Okay.
So, thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
And can I follow up?
Yes.
Does the league support this? Where's the league on this?
I don't know. And
which league?
The League of Oregon Cities. And they're not on the list to testify. And
Mr. Chair.
I don't see anybody here. Yes.
The league has not taken a position on this. My mayor is the chair of the league this year. So certainly if that's important, they will be on it and support it.
Spoken like a true CEO.
Yes, it was, wasn't
well
it?
Well put. We appreciate the league's support.
Okay. Okay, great. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill, whatever number we're on, 3224? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3224. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3224. I know that there's a few concerns here, committee members, but I think what I would like to do, because as I mentioned earlier, we are all of a sudden finding ourselves late in the session. Rather than hold this up, what I would like to do is I would like to ask Housing and Community Services, who just left, and the City of Beaverton to sort of continue talking. I would like you to kind of continue talking with Beaverton as this bill winds through the process. I don't want to hold it up because we're getting late in the session, as I mentioned earlier. If there are some amendments that are agreed to on the Senate side, I just would like to be made aware of those before the Senate actually acts on them, so that I'm aware of that, and then we can do a concurrency vote on the House side if that's something that is going to work.
Mr. Chairman, out of curiosity, will that mean that there will be an amendment that says I have to work with them?
Could be.
Okay.
It could be. Okay. So sort of with that sort of thoughts, I would like to, the chair will move the dash one amendments into House Bill 3224. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Then the chair would move House Bill 3224 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
For the record, I'll be voting no on this. At this point, I still have an uncertainty. I've referred to Section 3 on page 2 regarding increasing powers, I think across the board for all cities, for condemnation. And I want to get a little bit more information before I give a positive vote.
Okay, that's perfectly understandable. I do understand that. Any other discussion? Representative Nelson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, out of respect to the sponsor of the bill, I'm going to vote yes to get it passed. But I just, I really want to encourage a further amendment that gives the opportunity to cities of 25,000. You know, I think the proof is in the pudding. When we see that communities such as ours have billion-dollar corporations there, I think we have four. You know, we're restricted because of various situations, as in housing. And I just think it would be most beneficial, and I would certainly encourage it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other discussion? I would just point out that since this is sort of going down the path of lowering the population bar, that maybe 50,000 is a good place to sort of stop and pause, and then from there. Moving into, you know, if it's found that that's pretty, that cities that size are it's works well for them, then moving it further down in the future, or having the department set up a pilot program sort of administratively that they say, well, let's try it with these cities that are smaller. And I don't know if that's possible or not, but we could certainly work around that. But I'd like to kind of give it a shot at this level. I recognize that cities that are smaller than that, we have many of them that are quite sophisticated and have a lot of professional staff, but I think at the same time this is something that is very easy to get sort of lost in. So with that,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Nelson,
can I just add one more thing? According to ODOT, I can't exactly remember the year, they had projected there would be 750,000 people relocating from that metropolitan area of Portland down our way. And so I just hope.
By which year?
Well, by 2020. And so the only reason that I bring this up is, once again, I think whatever we do needs to be a plan for the future, not just for today.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. With that, Gina, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3224 is amended, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed and sent to the floor. Representative Avakian, would you carry this bill, please?
Please do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3224. And members, we have just a slight variance to the schedule. We have House Majority Leader Kim Knope here. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3219, long enough to take his testimony, and then we're going to I'm going to recess that, and we'll move on to another bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I appreciate the accommodation. State Representative Tim Knope from Bend. I'm here on House Bill 3219, and I just want to say from the outset that I appreciate Representative Kitts cutting his hair in solidarity on this bill. This bill is about the Oregon Youth Challenge, and as some of you may know about that program, it is a military in nature, military structure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'm wondering if there's an amendment already there for Representative Kitts to be one of the participants in the program.
I get no respect.
You're right. You don't. Okay. Go ahead, Representative, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The reason I came to testify is to highlight the importance of this program. It is a program that really targets 16 to 18-year-olds that are at risk. Essentially, they're dropping out or have dropped out. The structure focuses on education and discipline, and the goal of this school is clearly to get these at-risk youth to get back on track and make them productive members of society by adding that discipline and structure to their lives, as well as adding some meaning. The school also works to instill responsibility as well. Oregon Youth Challenge program has been extremely successful. 95% of their students who take the GED after completing their schooling pass on the first try. That's a very high number. This bill is about how we fund this program into the future. If I was sitting in your shoes, I would ask the question, well, you know, why can't we, like we probably will with a lot of other things, delay funding for this like we will for others until the next biennium when things look better? And the answer to that question is this program is specific. And there's a waiting list. And if we, as the state of Oregon, drop out of the program, we go to the end of the line. The waiting list, that last time I heard, there was 15, 16 states in line to get this program. And we probably wouldn't see this program again in Oregon for the unforeseeable future. So to delay this or not to fund it, this particular session would, I think, basically end the program. It has had general fund funding in the past. This would change that to state school funding and put in the ADMW. I think it's a 2.5 weighting. I think it's reasonable to take a look at this. These kids are just as important in our communities as the kids who are doing well. They just need a little bit of extra help. And this bill would allow us the opportunity to have that happen. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you about this bill and let you know that Oregon Youth Challenge has served all 30 kids from all 36 counties and continues to do so in a very successful manner. Having attended the graduation of some of these kids and watching them, you can clearly see that the folks who have left this program and are leaving this program will be the heroes of tomorrow. Many of them are going into the military, and I wouldn't be surprised to see some of these folks become our heroes of the future in terms of any military conflict. And it's just impressive to look at them, watch them, and see the progress that they made before entering this program and as they come out of this program. And I want to encourage you to pass this bill, support this bill, and do what you can to keep this program in Oregon and operating to help all of our communities. So thank you for your accommodation, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Are there any questions for Representative Knoop? Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knoop, can you tell me how many youths this program currently serves or would under this bill?
I can't. I know that the graduating class, I think they have two or three a year, and there are several hundred kids I know that go through the program on a regular basis, and it's not a large group in terms of essentially adding them to the funding of the state ADMW, but I know there are people who will come after me who will have exact answers for you as to, you know, exactly how many kids there are in the program, how many have graduated, and so on.
Speaking of heroes of the future, is it?
Are there any other questions for Representative Knoop?
We're speaking of class graduates.
Can I ask Representative Westland?
Well, you can ask Representative Westland, and what I'm trying to do is I need to get this bill recessed because I've got other members that are here that want to speak on other bills, and so I'd like to go ahead and get Representative Westland's comment, and if you can incorporate Representative Worth's question into your comment, that'd be terrific.
For the record, Representative Ben Westland, District 53, Central Oregon. Oregon Youth Challenge graduates two classes a year, 100 class or 100 cadets per, so that's approximately 400 cadets per biennium. And I sense that there is perhaps an urgency in our timeline this morning, so I'd just like to add my words of encouragement for the committee to consider this very worthwhile legislation. There are 10,000 Oregon high school kids that drop out of school every year. Obviously, that's 40,000 in the next biennium that will drop out. And the Oregon National Guard has literally discovered, indeed pioneered, a unique non-traditional educational model that many are seeking in our schools today. I mean, this program truly, genuinely works. And as we are finding in so many of the innovative models, you have the entry point where the kids, you know, are starting to take the left-hand turn off the proven path. They get into, quote, a program, and the program itself is absolutely exemplary. The numbers that come out of this, you know, 97-98% of the kids either get their GED or complete their actual high school diploma while in the course. And then the key to the whole program is the aftercare program. They have a year-long mentoring program done by volunteers. It is absolutely superlative. I could go on and on and on, but, Mr. Chair, in deference to your time, all I can say is a very heartfelt, passionate endorsement of this program. It is the number one youth National Guard youth challenge program in the country. Not my opinion, not Representative Knope's, but that's the National Guard's national evaluation. So this is a beyond worthwhile program, and I sincerely urge your sincere consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate it. Are there any questions for Representative Westman? Representative Worth?
A quick question. I'd yes. let you know where the program is located and where these kids typically come from, which county.
Thank you. The program is located just east of Bend, and there is approximately a 70-30 split between about 30% of the kids come from the local area and 70% of the cadets come from around the state, primarily Marion County and the Portland metro area.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, both, for being here. I appreciate it. Representative Nelson, I'm going to ask if you would hold off, because since you're here as part of the committee anyway, I can have you give your testimony later. I would like to recess. Pardon me? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I just want to just back Representative Knope and Representative Westland. Most importantly, having met many, many, many of these students, I just want to tell you that this program is beyond belief. And the main point I want to make is, having discussed this program with various superintendents of school districts, ideally to combine our efforts by taking those dropouts or potential dropouts from other public schools and putting them into the disciplinarian program that the Oregon National Guard provides would be an incredible program, and I think we'll find that the superintendents would support that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 3219. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3573. And I have a bill that I have to go testify on. So, Representative Przanski, if you would preside over this, please. And I see that we have Representative Dingfelder here. And so if she would go ahead and come forward, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Jackie Dingfelder, and I represent District 45, which is Northeast Portland. And I come before you today in support of House Bill 3573, which creates the Oregon Opportunity Commission. Oregon has the highest hunger rate in the nation, and more kids in Oregon per capita go to bed hungry every night than any other state. Thousands of Oregonians are just one paycheck away from losing their homes. And even as the economy grew in the 1990s, more and more Oregonians find themselves struggling to provide food, shelter, and other basic necessities for their families. While food pantries and emergency assistance programs across the state help with immediate need, they do not help solve the root cause of these problems. Poverty is the true cause and source of these and other problems that we face, and until we begin to address the problem of poverty in a meaningful way, we will never end the symptoms. House Bill 3573 will create a public-private partnership to promote economic opportunity for all Oregonians and reduce the incidence of poverty. The Commission will coordinate programs and resources, as well as fostering a culture of accountability among state agencies. Governor Kulongowski has emphasized economic development and hunger elimination of these two as his top priorities, and this bill supports the governor's priorities and provides an avenue for increasing economic opportunities and reducing the state's poverty rate. I wanted to note committee members, hopefully you have the Dash 1 amendments. I would refer to these over the original bill because there's been substantial changes. And I also want to note that I'm very sensitive to the fact that we're in very tight fiscal times. And you will note that this does not have a fiscal on it because we will be looking primarily for other sources of funding, including federal funding and private donations. So I'm going to end there. I need to return to my committee, and there'll be some other folks up here who can probably address some of your concerns. And I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here today and for your consideration of this bill.
Representative, I think just for the record, we want to make certain what you've handed out is a conceptual amendment. We don't have Dash 1,
correct,
but this is what you're envisioning,
correct,
to be.
It's a conceptual of the Dash 1s. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, any questions for the representative? Not seeing any. We have a couple of questions, and Representative Dingfelder, I don't know if these are for you. I'm going to go ahead and say what the questions are, and for those who are coming up in support may be able to give us the information if you don't have it. Need for monthly meetings. Need for power to subpoena, need for perpetual commission, and what sort of advisory relationship with the governor.
Okay. I will let the folks who are coming up answer those or address those, but I, again, appreciate the opportunity to be here.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have approximately 45 minutes before we're supposed to be shutting down because we're on the floor at 10:45. What I'm going to do is pull a panel up here, and hopefully I think everyone in this panel will be in favor of the bill. I have Rocky Johnson. I'm not sure if it's Jim Schussler. I'm sorry.
Schussler,
sorry. And let's see. Representative Repine, I see you're here, and Jack, are one of you want to come up now, or do you want to come up together as a separate panel?
Hey, all right.
Okay. All right. Rocky, if you'll start off.
Sure.
Please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rocky Johnson. I'm the director of Community Action Team. We are based in the northwest part of the state. We serve Columbia, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. I am here today speaking in support of HB 3573 on behalf of my agency and also as a member of the Community Action Directors of Oregon. I'm supporting the bill for several reasons. First of all, many of today's problems that we are facing, such as hunger, homelessness, and non-access to health care, are caused by poverty. Secondly, there is currently no mechanism within state government that is focused on the problem of poverty, and this bill would create that focus and allow us to put forth an agenda to reduce the incidence of poverty within the state. Third, our state, as you know, has been cited as having one of the highest income disparities and the highest rate of hunger in the nation, and I know that we can do better than that. Fourth, the proposed commission would create a public-private partnership to promote opportunities for low-income families that would reduce the incidence of poverty in the state. And finally, the Community Action Directors of Oregon are currently in the process of establishing a 501c3 corporation that will help raise funds for the commission. And these funds will be used to conduct the meetings and to pay for the necessary research and analysis needing to put forth an agenda to reduce poverty in the state. So with that, I'd like to end, and we can take questions once we're done with our testimony and try and get at your issues, Mr. Chairman.
That'd be great. Thank you. Jim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Schussler. I'm the executive director at Mid-Columbia Community Action Agency, serving Hood River, Wasco, and Sherman counties. I've worked with Community Action for the past 26 years. For the past 4 years, I've served as president of the Community Action Directors of Oregon, otherwise known as CADO. CADO is comprised of the executive directors of Oregon's 18 community action agencies, as well as several affiliate agencies like Oregon Food Bank, Oregon Heat, Oregon Energy Coordinators Association, and the Oregon Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. As designated by Oregon law, CADO serves as the official advisory body to Housing and Community Services on low-income issues, including recommendations on the allocation of federal and state anti-poverty dollars. We also work with the design, implementation, and evaluation of programs that benefit low-income people. Community action agencies were started in 1964 as a result of the Economic Opportunity Act signed by then President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Our mission then and now remains the same, and that's to eliminate the causes and conditions of poverty that exist in America. One way we can do that in Oregon is to support HB 3573, which would create an Oregon Opportunity Commission. This bill, if passed, would form a commission that would look at the underlying causes, conditions, and effects of poverty in our state and begin to develop new strategies and ideas to deal with these issues. This commission would be the first of its kind to address poverty from a much broader perspective than just a social service provider network. Instead, it would involve key players from several diverse backgrounds, business, government, private, education, social services, and et cetera, in looking at ways to reducing the effects of poverty in Oregon. We are number one in food insecurities, near number one in unemployed, and have had huge increases in housing and utility costs. We're not asking for any money to fund the commission, especially in light of our budget situation. Instead, we're taking active steps to secure funding for this commission from business and private sector donations. We feel these groups should be active participants in the discussion if we are to begin reducing poverty in Oregon. Today, we are asking the committee to support HB 3573 so that we can begin to address the poverty issues in Oregon, and we'd like to schedule a work session as soon as possible to move this forward. Thank you for your time today. Would also point out that one of our ecumenical ministries of Oregon is here to testify. They're not able to be here. They had another time commitment, but would speak in favor of the bill as well.
Thank you. Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. It's a pleasure to be here with my colleagues from the Cato organization. I've had the opportunity in the last 5 years to be the chair of a, by statute, structure called the Interagency Committee on Council on Hunger, ICCH. And this has been a very enjoyable and also challenging opportunity for myself and other agency directors to sit around at a common table to talk about the issues around hunger. As you've heard the previous speakers mention, that hunger is one of those components that is a piece of the poverty piece, along with housing and other things that add in, such as the job-wage balances. We have found in our 5 years of doing the Hunger Council work that when we can come together on the issue of hunger and put aside our own little turfy issues that we seem to bring to the table sometimes, we're able to get something great things accomplished. Now, has that made a difference in the hunger issues in the state of Oregon? Unfortunately, no. We're still in the top percentile of hunger deficiencies. But I would tell you that it probably would have been a lot worse if some of the suggestions that we did put in place had not come about. This brings the full picture of the poverty to a discussion table. And as opposed to us working on the hunger piece and somebody else working on the housing piece and somebody else working on the wage piece or somebody else working on a variety, I mean, poverty is the root cause here. And we need to look at that as and how can we find the solutions and not just treat it in a sustaining basis, but how do we make substantial changes in our either procedures or processes that will create outcomes that will change the poverty nature of the state. So I think this is a great opportunity. I applaud the group for coming to you saying we want to do this, and we're not going to charge you any ask for any money, which is kind of a good thing in today's environment. My staff and my agency stands ready, amongst other agencies who are very interested in this topic, to assist them in exploring the issues around poverty and improving better data and better opportunities for Oregonians and let more people out of the poverty issues in this state.
All right, thank you. The four questions that legislative fiscals ask us to put on the record, and if you could help us with, that would be great.
Sure.
First one is need for monthly meetings. This is something, can you tell us what's been envisioned for how regularly the commission would be meeting?
Yeah, we have discussed this, and we don't need to have monthly meetings. We were thinking more in terms of quarterly meetings as opposed to monthly meetings would probably be sufficient to move the work of the commission.
All right.
That's on those dash
proposals. And I think that's on the list of changes that we've been working on and should be before you shortly.
Okay. But we have not had a chance to go through the conceptual since they were just handed out this morning. Need
appreciate
for subpoena
that.
Power? Is that something that...
That is something that we request to be taken out of the bill. So
okay.
I think that section 4 has been requested to be deleted.
and need for a perpetual commission?
Well, hopefully we can solve the problem someday. this is something that's a rather large task, so it's going to take a while. We haven't really discussed a particular time allotment, but we're open to look at that consideration if that's something that the committee feels is important.
So at this point, ongoing, but possibly would be favorable to some type of a sunset clause for review if that's necessary?
Correct.
All right. And let's see, last one we had was what sort of advisory relationship with the governor?
Basically, the commission will put together a report every 2 years, and that report will go to the governor, and then the governor would be in a position to put forward those items or that agenda for action. So basically, we see it as an add to the governor in terms of being able to create some ideas about how to move the state forward and reduce the incidence of poverty.
Okay. Committee members, any other questions for this panel? Representative Nelson?
Thank you very much. I just want to tell you how proud I am of you. And while we work on many things here in the legislature, hunger undermines everything we do, whether it's economic development and education or anything else, and it's long, you know, encumbered, mm-hmm. The goodness of other good projects. And I think this is an outstanding concept. And I guess with it, we certainly want to be sure that we put in jobs. I mean, I think we really want to add that to mm-hmm. this to do. Mm-hmm. I support you totally. Would be pleased and honored to serve.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here today that wants to testify on House Bill 3573? If not, Mr. Chair, I think at this point we have conceptual amendments. It seems like we probably need to have them worked up into visual form. Maybe with the information we received on these four questions, we can take care of some concerns. And I'm going to ask the supporters of this bill to consider whether or not some type of a sunset clause would be appropriate, maybe 4 to 6 years out, to give an opportunity to work on and see where it's at and reflect, so we wouldn't have a commission that may just be there when it's not needed.
Sure. Appreciate that.
I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3573. Mr. Chair, do you want to go ahead and open the minute?
I'm taking from here. Thank you. I have lost my agenda. 2844. Thank you. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2844. And while Gina's bringing us the list, Patrick, you want to fill us in on this one, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2844 establishes a program in the Department of Veterans Affairs to provide payment for reasonable funeral expenses for certain veterans. It appropriates money to the department for the purposes of carrying out the program, declares an emergency, and sets an effective date of July 1st, 2003. The measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we have the -1 amendments before.
Okay, thank you. With that, I'm going to bring you up in panels, if that's all right. Greg Warnock, Walter Cruz, and John Mangus. And can we go ahead and have Wally Ordman come on up, too? And can we just make pull another chair up and just make four slots there? Is that okay? Apologize for the tight quarters, but what I want to do is just make sure that we get everybody up here sort of as quick as we can. Go ahead, Greg.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Greg Warnock. I'm the executive director of Oregon Veterans Association. And thank you for hearing this bill today. We also want to thank Representative Mabry for sponsoring this bill. As America's best soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines fight in a hostile military theater, our organization has gone on record to do what we can to build up the home front, take care of families of deployed Oregonians, and honor those who have served our country in previous conflicts. The Passion of Oregon Veterans Association's mandate stems from our understanding that while our state has more war veterans per capita than any other state in the Union, Oregon has not had the best reputation for taking care of its war heroes. The climate for change is at hand. Before the last general election, our political action committee sent a questionnaire to candidates asking them if they would support a funeral benefit for impoverished veterans who would like to be buried in one of Oregon's national cemeteries, but whose families do not have the means to cover the basic costs of body preparation, casket, and transportation costs. The bipartisan response from candidates and legislators alike was a resounding yes. OVA's legislative agenda was born from discussions with veterans and veterans' families. Of all of the issues that face military veterans, we found this issue to be one that can make a real difference for those who need the help most. Today we present a plan to help families of our war heroes carry out their final wishes. Our request is that the legislature develops a plan that will allow impoverished war veterans to receive a grant of up to $1,000 per impoverished veteran for basic funeral expenses. And the cost of this to the state will be about $300,000 per year. Our estimates of the program costs are from the following figures. There are approximately 368,000 veterans living in Oregon. 7.5% of Oregonian adults live below the federal poverty level. The annual death rate among veterans is approximately 2.35%. And of the 27,600 veterans who live in poverty, 650 die each year in Oregon. We believe that up to 50% of those have no funeral benefits or life insurance. We estimate that approximately 300 war veteran families need this grant assistance. Make sure that all of our war veteran heroes are buried with respect and the honor that they deserve. While we understand that the legislature struggles with huge budget issues, House Bill 2844 remains one of our most critical priorities. Our state leadership needs to remember the value of our war veterans. Too often we concentrate on our immediate concerns and forget the basic values that forged our nation. George Washington wrote that the best way to ensure our nation's security is to guarantee and guarantee a strong future military is to take care of our war veterans. And Calvin Coolidge said, "The nation which forgets its defenders will be itself forgotten." We should not consider this bill to be just another money program, but a solution, a reprioritization of our values. Oregon Veterans Association, our directors, advisors, and most importantly, our war veteran members ask for your careful consideration of House Bill 2844. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cruz?
For the record, my name is Walter Cruz. I'm the Oregon Legislative Representative for the Noncommissioned Officers Association. I and the association agree with this, and we support this bill and request that you send it forward with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Mangus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Mangus, Department of Veterans Affairs, and not surprisingly, I'm here to support anything you do that benefits veterans. Like medical care, the cost of dying has been increasing, and it is difficult for families to meet that expense to provide for a decent burial for their veteran family member, although they do receive some support from the VA in some instances. I would mention this is not in the governor's budget, so there's no money there. And there are a couple of issues in there that says the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs shall provide to implement this program. There is no money here for administration, and I would guess that it would take probably at least one person full-time initially and then maybe half-time later to get this thing off the ground. And I don't have that. I've reduced my staff from 612 to 124, and my general fund appropriation if the budgeted request for 2003-05 goes through, is 2% less than I received in 1989 to assist veterans. So there's not a lot of fat to provide for the administration of the program. Other than that, there are establishing the criteria on who is impoverished that would qualify for this, and I think we could possibly use federal VA guidelines for those who receive pension benefits, because that's a needs-based program. Other than that, I think it's a good program. Oregon has three national cemeteries, and this is kind of tied in with the utilization of those cemeteries. With all those comments or questions, I guess I support the bill.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let me go ahead and go to Mr. Ordeman.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name, for the record, is Wally Ordeman. I'm a fifth-generation funeral director from Albany and president-elect of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. The Oregon Funeral Directors Association finds this bill to be to have very tangible benefits to Oregon veterans, and we wholeheartedly support it. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have from the funeral home side of this.
Either way, your choice. Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for our panel? Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Mangus, Mr. Cruz, Mr. Warnock, and Mr. Ordeman. First of all, I guess I want to apologize for the $1 that we've given you over these years. I want to ask you, what happens now when a veteran cannot, I mean, there are no ways and means for them to be buried, and as a funeral director, what do we do?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. At this point, since 1984, when Social Security reduced the opportunity for people to claim the lump sum death benefit, and the VA paying only in situations where a veteran was receiving a pension or a disability from the VA, occasionally funeral homes unfortunately do run across situations where people cannot pay. And also, unfortunately, funeral homes, if a payment plan is not able to be worked out with family, because it is the family's responsibility for that bill, funeral homes out of community service end up absorbing those costs.
And a follow-up.
Follow-up.
Further, I guess I'll ask the committee, and certainly I support this bill and I do everything I can to help you make this happen. The least we could do, but I'm wondering, the funerals that in our family, $1,000 does not cover the funeral. And is this, I'm just wondering how this is broken down.
We did some research, and with the $1,000 that could be offered from the state, and most veterans qualify for an additional $300. And with some Social Security benefit, we think that with the funeral directors that we've spoken to said that they could manage and take care of the body prep, casket, and transportation to a national cemetery.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may supplement that answer as well. The way I understand the bill to read, the disposition or the burial would take place at Willamette National Cemetery or a national cemetery. So the grave space, opening and closing of the grave, the outer burial container, and the headstone would all be at federal government expense. So we are just talking about the funeral home expense of this equation, not the total equation.
Okay. So that would be including the actual cost of the funeral director and the casket. Is that?
That's correct. Those are the charges we're talking about.
Okay. That's great. Representative Mabry.
I would just like to, and it may all have already been covered, but, you know, when we originally brought this bill forward, we didn't really have any idea what it would take. We arbitrarily threw in a $3,000 figure, and when we did the arithmetic, it amounted to $1.8 million for the biennium, which scared us all to death. But we have since done some research. I, along with Mr. Warnock, were concerned about that number. I called, not knowing who else to call, my local funeral director, who took care of the burial services for my mother, and whom I trust and respect a whole lot. What I would like to say is that you know, right now in national news, we have a young lady whose name escapes me that has kind of become a poster boy for veterans, poster girl for veterans, I guess is a better word, having been shot and stabbed and two broken legs and a broken arm, and is a kind of a national hero. But she's like 19 or 20 years old, and 60 years from now, people won't remember who she is. The people that haven't forgotten who our national heroes are is our funeral survivors. They step up to the plate every time and do a vital service to our veterans. I think it's incumbent on the state of Oregon to help that. My local funeral director said that $1,000 would be more than enough to accommodate a reasonable burial cost, body prep, transportation, those kind of things, and in fact probably could be done for slightly less. God love them. They're wonderful folk, and so I encourage us to move this bill forward. I think it is entirely possible that we don't have to have a tremendous amount of overhead expense in the department. I suspect that my local veteran service agent could accommodate in helping this go through, and I don't think we would have to add a whole bunch of overhead, in spite of the fact that the veterans budget has been cut, and I feel bad about that. But I think we can make this work. I also think that that, you know, what we're looking at here is a kind of almost a worst-case scenario. I doubt that we will utilize these services to the extent it could be. But I think it's incumbent on us to recognize our veterans in time of war as well as in not time of war. And this is preparation for the future.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little concerned if this bill is indeed targeted and being put forth as a bill to help impoverished veterans with death benefits, with burial benefits. I guess I'm concerned that in the bill it doesn't specifically set up the guidelines as to determine the eligibility and define impoverished. And then when asked, I think it was, you know, well, we could leave it up to the federal VA pension guidelines. So I'm concerned because I, you know, many people know that I just lost my father, who was a Korean vet, and we just we cremated him, and just recently this month. So I'm pretty aware of the costs, and we didn't have any help in doing that. So I think it's important that we tighten up those eligibility requirements. So can you tell me how does the VA pension guidelines, how does that differ from like the federal poverty line?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, the federal VA pays two different types of benefits. One is for service-connected disabilities, where the injury or disease was incurred in service, and they pay a pension benefit, which is, you know, considered a gratuitous type benefit based on the fact that you were served during a wartime period, served honorably, and you have limited income. And I don't know exactly what the income limitation was, but if you were a single vet, your annual income would have to be under, I think it's like $1,500 a month, something like that, which isn't a lot of money. Any additional money that you have is subtracted from that amount. But that's basically a person who has very limited income and maybe little or no assets. I don't know what kind of criteria Greg had in mind, but that's the same individual that we looked at originally that we would try to assist at the Oregon Veterans Home up in the Dalles, was the person that was receiving a pension or maybe Social Security, who really had no other alternatives other than Medicaid or a welfare-type benefit. The VA pays a death benefit only under certain circumstances, and this has changed over the years. It used to be much more available to individuals, but if a person dies as a result of a service-connected disability, the VA can pay up to $2,000 for the preparation and everything of the funeral, and then if it's buried in the National Cemetery, the opening, closing of the grave and the headstone and that sort of thing. But if it's pension, if it's a non-service-connected death, the individual has to be receiving some type of a VA benefit, which could be a service-connected benefit, but he didn't die as a result of that, or pension, and then they can pay up to $300. I think that's the rate today. So it's not a lot. The only real benefit is if there is availability in a national cemetery to cut down on some of the cost of the grave site itself and the opening and closing and the headstone. I couldn't give you a definition of a poverty guideline, and I don't know what it is nationally, but the cost of dying, like cost of medical, it's expensive, and a lot of people just don't have the money to provide the service they would like to provide for that family member. But again, it's not in the governor's budget either.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone, let me ask this, is there anyone that wants to testify in opposition to this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2844. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2844. Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 1 amendments into 2844.
Thank you. Representative Brzezinski moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2844. Is there any discussion? Or is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2844 as amended to Ways and Means with a DPAS recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves, by subsequent referral, moves House Bill 2844 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a DPAS recommendation. Is there any discussion? Gina, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Absolutely, yes.
Oh. Aye.
No.
Aye. House Bill 2844, having received a constitutional majority, is moved to the Committee on Ways and Means with a DPAS recommendation. We don't need a carrier for that. Thank you. I'm going to close a work session on House Bill 2844. I'm going to open a work session on a public hearing on House Bill 3272. And would you, Patrick, fill us in on this while Gina is bringing us the material, please?
Sure, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3272 adjusts the boundaries of Linn County and its adjacent counties. We have the dash four amendments before us, and I believe those amendments will be discussed by some of the people who will be coming to talk.
Okay, great. We have with us, let me call Roger Nyquist and Bill and Carla Chambers. If I can just have you all come up together, please.
This is mine.
Ready, go ahead and start. We're on a tight time frame here. We need to roll along, so please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for considering this morning. For the record, my name is Roger Nyquist. I'm a Linn County Commissioner representing Linn County before you this morning. I will be brief and to the point of this and let some affected residents and the county surveyor get into the technical parts of this. For us, this is a pretty simple bill. What we're asking you to do is update legislation that is some 150 years old, and that would be state statute 201020. And for us, it's as simple as the center of the river means center of the river. It doesn't mean center of the river as it existed in 1847. It means center of the river as it exists today. I have submitted to you two handouts. One would be a letter from the Linn County Assessor dated back in 1962. And the point of that document is that it's been previous practice, at least in Linn County, that when the river moved and there were river, and there was then property on the other side of the river that was not adequately serviceable by Linn County, we just transferred that to Benton County's possession. The second document I've provided is an article from the Albany Democrat Herald dated back, we actually appeared last summer, and the way all of this came to my attention was that we had a group trying to form a special district, and they could not come up with a one-line legal description of the county of the district they wanted to form, because they, in using the center of the river, which is defined as our county boundary, did not coincide with what's been put into practice in some cases in the past, in the fact that the center of the river was referenced back to the 1850s when counties were formed. So it became quite a mess. We had a number of meetings over it, and I at least became committed to solving this boundary issue and updating state statutes. And from there, I will turn it over to surveyor, I guess.
Good morning, committee chairman and committee members. My name is Roger Latham. I'm Linn County surveyor. And I guess I may be the crux of the problem here, I guess, because I brought it to Mr. Nyquist's attention. Let me just give you a little brief history about this. Many of the descriptions you find in ORS Chapter 201, which is county boundaries, are currently they're built around descriptions of when those counties were formed back in the 1847s and 45s and such. Linn County and Benton County happened to be 1847. Then they accept out other portions of counties from the whole picture. And like with Linn County, our eastern boundary basically is a reference to another county. It's referenced to the adjoining county as the eastern boundary of Linn County as the summit of the Cascades and the western boundary of Deschutes County. So you have to refer back and forth to different things. The problem is the county boundaries were accepted at statehood, and the location of the river has changed significantly since then. With dams now regulating the Willamette River, a lot less chance for significant change, except for possibly the 500-year floods like we had in 96. The issue about the boundary change isn't a new issue either.
Thank you.
It's been around for at least 40-some years, and since I've worked for Linn County since 1968, I can remember at least three other attempts to do something, and they failed to materialize for various reasons until now. The perception of the public, you know, landowners, is that if I'm on the left side of the river, I'm in Benton County or Lane County. If I'm on the east side of it, I'm in Linn County. And that really isn't the case in some instances, because the old river location has now changed significantly. And this has caused a lot of different problems. Some of the issues that can be dealt with are dealt with on a handshake, kind of a arrangement between jurisdictions. It's not a legal binding operation by any means. I just want to remind you to please remember that this is a political boundary change. We are not changing any ownership of the land. What people own on the land will not change. It's just the political jurisdiction we're talking about. Having said that, here are a few of the issues that you know, can cause problems, like with the assessor tax collector. Tax lots are in error. Linn County says, okay, everything on that side of the river, Benton County, you assess, everything on the other side, Linn County assess. It's sort of a, you know, fudge-fudge of things. The clerk, I'm sure there's precincts that are incorrect because they go to the old county boundary. There may not be residents on the other side of the river, but there are precincts that actually go there. Planning and building environmental health folks, they are also always in a struggle trying to decide who's going to issue permits for building things on the river. Anything, anywhere close to the river, they either wind up going to one county being referred to the other or tossed back and forth between counties. And ultimately, somebody will finally say, okay, I'll issue a permit, right or wrong. The sheriff, They need to know where that boundary is, because if there's a criminal case out there and suddenly, you know, you have a murder case and it's on the wrong side of the line, that's not a good deal. From the surveyor's perspective, we have surveys that we don't have a record of, even though they're in Linn County. I'm sure they're in the adjacent county, and we don't get copies of them, and we need to. Different districts, they describe their boundaries going to the middle of the river. Well, the middle of the river was from 1859, and it has changed. Maybe I'll just jump ahead real quick, because we have some handouts that you have, but if you look at the photo here, the yellow line is the current county boundary, and this is primarily from Lane County up to Albany. And the red line is a line where we actually took a boat and went down the middle of the river and did some GPS work. It was an interesting project. But as you can see, there are significant changes in different areas where the river's moved, and we need to fix it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Does the yellow line represent where the river used to be?
Correct.
Well, we think it was in 1850.
Okay.
Right. The solution is we need to change the boundary to reflect the current location of the middle river. There's lots of entities that rely on that. The proposed language in Amendment 4 will make it a lot easier to do that in the future should it ever become necessary to do it again. Most of the services, or probably all the services, are currently provided by whatever side of the river that property happens to lie on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Sorry, Darren. Just a quick question. That regardless of where the river used to be, according to this map,
right,
is the line that depicts where the river is now accurate?
Yes.
Okay.
It was done with GPS, which I assume folks are all sort of familiar with.
Thank you. That's my picture.
But anyhow, all the services are provided by whatever side of that river, you know, the property actually happens to lie on, whether it's to the west side or the east side, and that's how they get into it. So seems only common sense that that should be the county line. Linn County has done all the necessary location work to identify this, as well as prepare legislation and stuff. And I just, maybe this isn't appropriate at this time, but there's a state organization called ORMAPS, which is a state GIS group, and they are very interested in knowing where the county boundaries are and where they are accurately located, because currently, you know, Linn County may have a line drawn around here, and Marion County may have a different line drawn around there, and they don't match, and they need to. So, but they have some funding that would help provide whatever additional costs for transferring documents back and forth, because that's part of the bill, too, is we have to transfer documents.
Mr. Lincoln, I want to see if I can interrupt you for a moment.
Sure.
Looking at how much time we have left before we need to be shutting down, I know that there's other proponents here as well as people in opposition. What I'd like to do is ask you, from the committee's perspective, if you have gone through the legislative intent of the previous legislation to set the boundaries back at the time of statehood or subsequent to that, that reflects that it was the intent of the legislature to maintain a boundary that would be at the center point of the river.
Well, I was hoping to get the chance to talk about legislative intent back in 1850 today. I mean, and if you think back when they did that, they used the center of the river for a reason, and it was the only practical way to get services to folks, and at that time, whatever services they were providing in an efficient manner. And we think this is consistent with the spirit of that.
Okay, and do you have that documentation or where you've done your research on the history?
I would say that it's probably more a matter of practicality. Back in the 1850s, the land wasn't surveyed, and so the natural barriers being the rivers or the mountain crests, that's how they described it.
Okay.
So I don't know whether there's any legislation.
Ms. Latham, let me ask you, if there's any other comments that you'd like to share with us now? If not, I'm going to ask the chambers to go ahead and put their comments on the record.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Okay. Perfect. When I read the amendments, is it your intent, or how I read it and wondering why it would be fit to authorize the Linn County surveyor, basically giving you the authorization and the ability to determine county lines?
Well, actually, when we determined this, it was a joint venture between us and Benton County. In fact, we went down a river together, basically, in two different boats. And from all of the affected county surveyors' perspective, we've looked at this on aerial photos like this, and everybody's in agreement. There's no problem with location. Just happens to be I was the one that sort of did it, I guess. That's why it's in there that way.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So, but am I reading this correctly that you would have, it says that you would have, you would in the future be able to be authorized the ability to determine county lines, and is that true of all other surveyors?
Where's the representative referencing? Page 2.
And maybe further.
That's the way it's written in there right now.
Sure.
And like I said, I don't expect it's going to be years before that has to be done again, quite honestly. At least I hope so. I think you could change that if you wanted to say, instead of determined by a Linn County surveyor, by the appropriate county surveyor for the adjacent counties or whatever, the affected counties.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see, Bill and Carlos Chambers.
My name is Carla Chambers. My husband Bill and I own Saltbush Island Farms, which is located on Saltbush Island, currently in Benton County. We do farm. We have farms in Linn, Benton, and Lane County. If this bill passes, we will still have farms in Linn, Benton, and Lane County. We have employees that live in all three of those counties. Our main farm is on, or our main headquarters is on Saltbush Island. It's a farm and a food processing, an on-farm food processing facility. I think what's been pointed out is really at the heart of the matter. It makes government very inefficient when the natural boundary that everybody thinks is the county boundary suddenly is not the boundary. And I would cite three specific instances where that has really been difficult to run a business when you're in that scenario. First, it's been voting. Up until vote by mail, Bill and I traveled 22 miles round trip to vote. It seems pretty silly when you're 4 miles from a major city. Sheriff, Linn County Sheriff, one night, is we find in the middle of the island, thinking he was in Linn County. Because of the natural boundary of the river, he genuinely thought he was in Linn County. Well, he wasn't. He was technically in Benton County. I think the biggest challenge we have faced over the last 18 years is road maintenance and infrastructure. You traveled to my farm today. The potholes are horrendous. We have national carriers that have threatened not to come in to haul our farm product off the island because of the infrastructure. We've been in a situation where Benton County road maintenance has had to go through downtown Corvallis, out across the bridge, across the Willamette River, into Linn County, and into then back into Benton County to Saltbush Island to grade our road twice a year. Well, when you have 100 and some employees traveling that road every day, it has not been efficient or easy for Benton County to maintain Saltbush Island, and it's been very difficult for them to handle that infrastructure and to provide those services in an efficient manner. So Bill will talk just a minute about the river, but we are in favor of putting this particular farm into Linn County and believe that it probably has been in Linn County all along.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Chambers, and one of the questions that's going to come up is, will the river change course again? And God only knows, but I just don't believe so for three reasons. That the first one is that when the river did change courses, it was always associated with a catastrophic flood, a 1-in-500-year event. The last time it changed courses in this particular reach of the river where we are affected was in the early 1890s, and it was associated with a flood that the water level was 8 to 10 feet higher than what it was in February 96. So it's truly a catastrophic flood. Those types of floods are unlikely because of the flood control dams on the upper Willamette. There's also been tremendous changes that have occurred since that time. The river typically would change from one channel to another, and most of those channels have, or the old channels have since been filled in, and so that there wouldn't be the energy or that natural place for that water to flow. Remember, water flows through a path of least resistance, and so that's going to be the shortest distance from one point to the next. And currently, the river is in that shortest point in the particular reach where we're affected. The second point is that there's been tremendous investment in bank stabilization. That the Corps of Engineers, the state of Oregon, has invested millions and millions of dollars over the last 4 years trying to stabilize the river because of the tremendous cost when the river does change. And then the third reason is the state and the city of Corvallis just wouldn't, it wouldn't be acceptable for the river to change course from where it is right now. The city of Corvallis gets, I believe, 70% of its water out of the Willamette River, and the water intake works is currently on the westernmost boundary of where the river would go, and for the river to change course, it would leave Corvallis without water. And then there's just been tremendous investment in bridges and highways, specifically Highway 34, that if the river were to change course, it would break through in a different place. I just don't think, even if a flood occurred, we would allow it to stay in a new course just because of the expense. It would be put back into its currently existing course. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Ward.
Mr. Elbush, the road that you were referencing, is that a private road or is that a public road?
That has been a county road for the 18 years up until 2 years ago when Morris Brothers asked for a mining permit. And as part of that permit, Benton County required Morris Brothers to take over the ownership and maintenance of that road.
Okay.
Yes.
Sure. How do the other, do you all know how the other counties named in this bill feel about the bill?
Thank you. For the record, Roger Nyquist. I knew how they felt about October. I did go from county to county. Marion County viewed this, let me describe it, as a housekeeping issue. Lane County viewed this as, yeah, we ought to try to get along and we ought to firm this up. And as long as you're willing to go to the Capitol and take care of it, we're right there with you, Nyquist. Polk County later became part of that. Just and there's just a short portion. They initially had some concerns, but as I understand it, they are now okay with this legislation as well. And we have had a difference, an honest difference of opinion with Benton County about this legislation. We have talked with them, and it really became a slippery slope of conversation-wise. We just disagree on the value of having an accurate county boundary along the river there.
Mr. Nyquist, one thing I guess I'd ask you, based on your testimony that last time you checked in with the other counties was in October, now that we have Dash Force, that might make some difference. I don't know if it will or wouldn't. Maybe if you could do a call through to those counties and individuals you've spoken with.
I certainly will. The surveyor has been in contact with their surveyors, and
I was going to say, I have talked with Marion County and Polk County last week, and they've talked with their boards, and both of them are okay with it.
Okay.
And Lane County, they wanted me to come down and do a presentation, but we were waiting for this amendment for a thing, but the surveyor has talked with the board down there, and they're okay with it, too.
All right. Any other questions for this panel? If not, I'm going to bring up the other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having been the other county without a boundary, which we just recently settled, Yamhill and Polk, I sure have a great understanding for you. I guess the financial impact is probably the big one in this situation as far as the property owners. Is that not true, or am I crazy? We should don't Both. Answer that. Take it back. No, but I mean,
we have been told, or I have been told by the Benton County Assessor, that our
tax burden would actually increase by moving to Lane County. I don't know if that's true or not. That's what
Lynn or Lane or where are you going?
To Lynn County, excuse me.
I kid.
I don't know if that's true or not. I have not done the calculations. It's a difficult calculation to determine.
And then a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Question.
The concern for how, you know, those property taxes are handled. I mean, I hope, you know, that we're not immediately dunning people who had no idea they were going to have a tremendous property tax increase. I don't see that here, and so I'd be curious. It would be wonderful to have that information.
Let me speak to the big picture and the impact of all of this. Through this five counties, there are two residents and one home and two businesses that will be moved, and the chambers represent the majority of that. Other than that, this is all just floodplain farmland that needs to be adjusted, and it's all in farm deferral anyway, and the impacts would be minimal to everybody.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to go ahead and call up the next panel. I have Jay Dixon from Benton County. Was there anyone else with Mr. Dixon from Benton County that was going to be coming up?
Understand why this bill is so complex.
And again, our time is limited, so if you could be as concise as you can in your testimony, and please identify yourself for the record as you speak.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. The opportunity to be here. I'm Jay Dixon, Chair of the Benton County Board of Commissioners. My colleagues are here, Linda Mazzarell on my left and Annabelle Jaramillo on my right. And Doug Hillcott, who is our assessor. I will not, you have copies of my testimony, so I will not go through it all in the interest of time. Obviously, we oppose this bill to transfer the commercial property that you've heard about from Benton County. Our reason for opposition, if we're going to change the boundaries, let's not change it to something that continues to change. The river will continue to change. We don't know how much, we don't know when. But there are other alternatives for fixing the boundary. We have no objection to talking with Lynn County or any of the other counties about that. It just doesn't make sense to us to change it to the river. And we'll, somebody will be back here again in the future wanting to change it because the river is changed. Although you've heard that all the counties affected by the boundary changes agree with the bill, that's not our information. A majority of Fulton Lane County commissioners said that unless all counties agree, the boundary adjustment should not occur. We had no input into this bill. We opine that there's no legal precedent for one county redrawing boundaries without the consent of the affected county. Setting such a precedent, we think, would be ill-advised. The proposed Lynn County amendment to this bill that Representative Wirth asked about would indeed allow Lynn County to make future boundary changes as well. Third, this bill allows one county to take property tax revenues from another county without agreement of compensation. The property affected by this bill produces about $46,000 in annual taxes for Benton County, and we lose that amount. Our information from the assessor is that the chamber's tax bill would not increase, but go down about $2,000. So that's not a significant issue, I don't think, for them. But the $46,000 in annual taxes for us is a significant issue. In addition to that, it would cost us about $17,000 to implement this change. And that's the cost of mapping, recording transfer of the property from one county to another, and updating the assessment records. $47,000 or $46,000 may not seem like much. $17,000 may not seem like much. But in this environment where we're suffering other major funding cuts, I know you appreciate that. We can't surrender tax revenues for no other reason. So in summary, our argument is that the river will continue to change course. We've had no input into and disagree with the proposed boundary changes that are suggested. We'll lose significant property taxes. And we think it's poor public policy to allow one county to expand its boundaries without the consent of the affected county. We think these are reasonable arguments, and we urge you to reject this bill.
Thank you. Were there anyone else that wanted to make comments at this time from the panel? Questions from the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else here that wanted to give testimony on House Bill 3272? In that case, we'll go ahead and close public hearing on House Bill 3272. And, Mr. Chair, we have a couple of representatives that have come and gone that wanted to be here for testimony.
Okay, on separate bills? Okay. Let's see. With that, then, let's...
I think here's Jeff for the last few months.
Okay.
I think Jeff wanted to testify on this bill, did he not?
Yeah.
Representative Krupp, did you want to testify on 3272?
Oh,
okay.
No,
it's a different one.
Sorry.
Okay. Let's go ahead and open a...
he's here on this one. Do you want to just get his testimony?
Okay. Let's do this. I've got three people I need to accommodate with different bills. So I think what I'll do is come back to 3272 in a couple of minutes. Let me have the closest guy. He already closed it, didn't he?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me open a public hearing on House Bill. If we don't get any other testimony, because everybody else is in the building, where's the gal from Colonel Caldwell? If you, okay. We have a guest that came all the way from Sacramento, California to testify on House Bill 3219, and I want to get that testimony. Then yes, sir. Yeah, hang on, Commissioner. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to reopen the or take out of recess the public hearing on House Bill 3219. And would you go ahead and just come on up, please? I understand from Colonel Caldwell that you all came over from a long ways away, and I'd like to get your testimony on the record. Committee, just for your information, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, on House Bills 3114, 3268, and the other bills that are on the agenda, I'm going to tap those through so that we can still work them. And I'm going to, as far as testimony is concerned, anybody that has written testimony, please, for any of those bills, I'll please give that to Gina so that we make sure that we get that on the record. So go ahead, please. Why don't you start?
I'm Haley Ford Harris. I'm a former cadet of the Oregon Youth Challenge Program. And before the program, I was skipping school a lot. Pretty much I just went to the important classes like basketball and lunch. I'd rather spend my time smoking weed and getting into trouble than worrying about my education and like trying to better myself. Turning point for me is a friend and I. We were arrested for burglary and theft. We had broken into our school. Thought it was, a cool thing to do. And, spending time in the juvenile detention center wasn't a whole lot of fun for me. And so I turned to the Youth Challenge Program for help to kind of get me back on track and to set myself straight. And while I was there, I was one of the top academic people. I was in the top 10%. I was a student tutor. I helped out a lot with other kids who were struggling more than I was. I was the first female drill team sergeant. I had a team of my own where we flipped rifles and had a bunch of fun with that. I really learned a lot in the Youth Challenge program. I'd definitely say I learned more in school at Youth Challenge than I did the whole time I went to school. And it was just like totally shocked me, like all the stuff I just didn't even know about with English and math and all of that. And it really helped out a lot. And I was pretty much amazed at what I could do that being in regular school really didn't help me out at all. And the people at Youth Challenge, they tell you that they're there for you, for us and nobody else. And they really help and they really support us. And I think that helped out a lot while we were there. People actually cared about us and told us that, and they were there for our improvement, and I think that helped out a lot. Since Youth Challenge, I got my high school diploma there. I was able to earn enough credit to get my diploma. Right now I'm talking to the Marine recruiters and the Navy recruiters, and I really want to have a career in the military and hopefully one day be in government, a representative or a senator, possibly president of the United States, one of the,
all right,
you know, something like that. And Youth Challenge really helped me to achieve my goals while I was there. They really helped me set high standards for myself, and I would do anything for this program. This program is amazing, and I'd like to say that people who oppose this program, I just challenge you to go to Youth Challenge. Go to a graduation. Go to something. Because once you see the pride and all of that that these cadets have once we graduate, it's totally amazing. From orientation to graduation is a big change. And I think without this program, it's really going to hurt everyone.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Ashley Rose. I'm 17. I'm known as former cadet Pangolinan. I also was in a lot of serious trouble with my school. I skipped daily. Class was nothing that I was concerned about. My grades pretty much almost failing all of them. I didn't care about school. And nobody was there to help me. I wanted so bad to get my diploma because I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to do something, but I couldn't because I couldn't stay in school. I didn't have the self-discipline, and nobody was there to help me. I looked to my counselors. They couldn't help me. I looked to my teachers. They were too busy, and there was too much, I don't know, something, too many lessons planned, too many grade papers to grade, that I wasn't a priority to them because they thought I was just another stereotypical teenager, a skipper, somebody doing drugs or something. I don't know what they thought, but I wasn't a priority to them, and I tried so many other schools. My family couldn't afford private school, so that wasn't an option. I tried 21st Century, but it's a lottery-based entrance. You have to be in a lottery, and they pick names, and my name wasn't chosen. And it was no telling if I would be chosen next year or the year after that, or eventually I would have been too old to go there. And I tried Wainema, the program at Chemeketa, the high school completion program, but it was too expensive, and the lines, the waiting list to get in a scholarship was 40 people long, and I needed help immediately. I couldn't wait. I dropped out. I wasn't going to be able to. I dropped out twice when I was in high school, but I wanted my diploma, so I went back, and I dropped out again, and it didn't work. And so I heard about the challenge program, and I applied, and I got in, and they were there to help me. I can't even tell you how important this program is. I wouldn't have my high school diploma if it wasn't for this program. When I went there, I was somebody who was failing and who wasn't going to be a graduate. I was just going to be another statistic. Because this program was there and these people cared about me, I made it. I got my diploma. And I can't tell you how much that means to me. When I went there, I was an F student, and I graduated on honor roll.
All right.
I learned so much. I learned before I just thought I was my own person, and I did it, whatever I wanted all by myself. But when I went there, I learned teamwork, and I learned camaraderie. I learned that to have a team was to be somebody and to mean something. Because unless we're a community and unless we're a group of people, nothing can get done. And that's what it took for me, was those people that cared about me and my platoon backing me up and me backing my platoon. And if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't be in college now. I'm in college now on my second term.
All right.
My GPA is a 3.5, and that's incredible, from going from Fs to getting A's and B's. If it wasn't for that program, I wouldn't be where I am today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Michael Hitty, and I was kind of in the same boat as these girls. I wasn't really getting in trouble with the law, but I was getting in trouble with my family. Like, it wasn't working out for us, and my school life wasn't working out. I wasn't going to class all the time, and I was kind of being a flake about everything. And then my counselor, he showed me the paperwork and some videos on the program, and I didn't really know about it, so I went to the orientation, and then I told my mom I wanted to do it, and she didn't want me to because she didn't want me to leave her for 6 months. But my first break, I came home, and she said I totally changed, and it was after a month and a half. the program wasn't even complete yet, and I've already changed so much. And I was helping out around the house and all that, but I hadn't been to school yet. So I guess that was a real test. So when I got back from boot camp, or challenge program, I got back into school, and then people were looking at me different, and they're saying I was more respectable, and my grades are all up. I was getting straight F's, and now I'm getting, like, season up. I haven't got any F's.
All right.
And my mom is proud of me, and I never heard her say that before, like, until I got home. And she's really proud of me, and I know she is. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Is this the proud mom sitting behind you that's kind of beaming and waving? Okay. Welcome, Mom. Thanks for being here.
Mr. Chair.
If you have a question, please keep it to a question. We've really got to move along. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you think that this program should be the alternative school for all dropouts or potential dropouts of school? Would you see that as a great redeemer for lots of more kids like you and probably other friends? Would you support that premise?
I wouldn't be here if I didn't support it.
Definitely.
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Worth and then Representative Kitts.
Can you all tell me what high schools you had formerly gone to and if your high schools provided you with any kind of programs for dropout prevention?
Yes, me and I went to Aloha High School, and I was involved in something called Project Success. And it was a class that kind of checks you and tries to keep you up on your grades, gives you these little slips that you take your classes and do your homework. But I was skipping out on all my other work and everything, so I decided, why do I need to do that? So I kept going to that class, but I never filled out the sheets, and I ended up failing that class. I don't know how I did that, but I managed to do it.
I went to Sprague High School, and I was never told of anything. I went to my counselors, and we were trying to work on ways that I could stay in school, but none of it worked, and she never gave me any guidelines or any classes or anything.
I went to North Valley High School, and I was never approached really by anybody other than my parents about my skipping school and my failing grades. So.
Where's North Valley?
Torrance Pass.
Thank you. Thanks, you guys.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kitts?
I just be aware that you don't have to have a 3.5 GPA to go into politics. And George W. and myself proved that.
But you have to be a cheerleader.
Thanks. You don't even have to have 2.0.
I did pass. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for this panel? I'd like to thank you very much for coming today. I apologize for keeping you waiting and having to sit through all of the other stuff. Anyway, so thank you for being here, and thank you for coming all the way from Sacramento to be with us. Thank you. With that, I'm going to... Yes?
We have some very pertinent information
that
we need to share.
Okay. Come on up. Please understand, I'm short because we've got to get to the floor, and I've got some other business that I'm trying to get through the committee. This bill is going to come back to us. It's not going to go anywhere today. And I just want to let you know that because I know there's a lot of people that want to testify on this bill, and I just don't have time.
Appreciate that.
Go ahead.
My name is Ed Duenas. For the record, first off, thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Edward Duenas. I'm a counselor at Aloha High School. Your mayor is a social science teacher at our site. Jessica Lynch is the young woman that you were referring to there, Representative Mabry. Moving from California to Oregon 3 years ago, I have worked constantly over the years with at-risk youth, with students who have not attended school, and I have sought out numerous alternative options and programs for these kids. In California, there is a program of this nature in San Luis Obispo, much too far from residents of San Diego to move up there and to be successful. here. It's incredible. This is a list of my kids that I have referred to the Oregon Youth Challenge. In my 3 years here, this is concluding my sixth semester, I have sent 30 students to Oregon Youth Challenge. 27 have been successful. I will say that at this point, we have five of the students who have finished the program are currently in the armed forces. One is in a junior ROTC program at one of the local universities. 10 have graduated from high school. 9 are seniors on track to graduate with their class off of that 5-year or 6-year plan that I refer to for some high school students who are not successful in their early grades. 2 are juniors who are currently back on track, back in control, and unfortunately one has moved to Idaho. 10 of them were Hispanic.
We don't want to hold that against them, though, right?
Yeah, really. 10 of them were Hispanic, 14 have been white, 2 are Asian, 1 African American. The changes in these students are incredible. They have become extremely more self-disciplined. They have accepted more responsibility for themselves, for the choices they are going to be making. They have become self-motivated. They have become more positive. They have seen more hope. You always say you see the light at the end of the tunnel. In the past, with my kids, I'd say the light at the end of the tunnel has been a locomotive that has been coming straight at them. Currently, that light is now the beautiful blue sky and the bright hope for the future that these kids see in themselves. They are more attentive. They are more focused. They are more respected, as Michael Hitty had expressed how he has seen in the community and at our school site by his classroom teachers. These kids, these little tiny things that seem so tiny that 6 months away, make an incredibly huge difference in not just themselves, their families, and the community, but also in the bright future that these kids now see for themselves. This program, they refer to it as a second chance opportunity. That's how they like to acknowledge it. That's how they like to promote it. I see it in so many cases, and I think you've heard from the young people that presented just before us. It was their last chance. When I see in the Oregonian that 33% of the teenagers in Oregon do not graduate, that is startling. When you look at the unemployment rate in Oregon and being one of the tops in the nation, that is alarming. When I have 20-year-old kids returning to me saying, Mr. Duenas, I realize that that GED wasn't sufficient. I realize that not having that diploma isn't going to help me. I'm coming back. I'm glad that Oregon accepts children until they're 21 to graduate from high school. California, they don't. 18, they're out the door. They're gone. They're history. And good luck to them. You know, this is a program that is exclusive, not exclusive, that is unique. It is a program that works. It's a program that needs to stay in Oregon. And I can't say that enough.
I'm just going to say, because I get too emotional when I talk about this, that I am completely back this program. It's very important, and it does need to stay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What is your name?
I'm sorry?
What is your name?
My name is Charmaine. Charmaine?
Your name?
Yeah, I need you to state your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Charmaine Polizzi.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you both for staying in there with us. We have two other people that have come to testify on this bill that are from more than 100 miles away, so I want to have them come up. Commissioner Luke, would you come on up, please? And then Tom Clifford from the advisory board. And Representative, we're going to get to 3114 next.
Mr. Chair, Andy Andrews.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Luke, Deschutes County Commissioner and a member of the board of the Oregon Youth Challenge since 94. Those students who were just up here is the reason that we support this program, been a very good advocate for this program. I'll just point out that on Channel 2 on Sunday night I was watching the news and they were doing their hometown heroes, and the young man was an Oregon Youth Challenge graduate, and they mentioned that. Education is one of the biggest things here. Many of the kids get enough credits to graduate with their class. Some of those who don't graduate with their class get enough credits to go back to their school and graduate, and many of them take the GED. In the last go-around, the ones who took the GED, they had 95% passed on the first try.
All right.
People who come from my generation and earlier, like many of our peers, had an opportunity to go to jail or go into the military. They don't have that opportunity anymore. This program gives these kids an opportunity to change their lives, and 25% of them do go into the military, but 75% of them don't go into the military and go back and do other things with their life because of the self-assurance and the discipline they've learned from this program. And I know you're tight, Mr. Chairman, and I will thank you very much for letting us put our testimony on the record.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Very briefly, my name is Andy Andrews. I am chairman of the advisory council or advisory board of the Youth Challenge Program. Very briefly, I live in the alfalfa area. I have a ranch out there, and I want to let you know when this thing first came out there and they started talking about this boot camp, as they call it, I was very much against this whole thing. And in the meantime, we met with the people. They convinced us that it was a great program, and it certainly is. I was going to read a couple of letters. I don't need to, incidentally. I have 209 letters from parents and students that were written to me after our last graduation. I asked them to write me letters. I think, Dennis, someone has those letters that they can. We will get those to you. And I don't think I need to say too much. I think these young kids here, especially one's going to be one of our future presidents, what great kids. I think they've explained to you what we really need to know. To me, there are several just real quick points. Number one, we need to save the program. There's no question about that. Number two, everybody's a winner. The taxpayers are winners. The people in education are winners. The public safety system is certainly, they're certainly winners. You, as far as elected officers, you certainly win. The youth win. The military wins, because 25% of these kids who go through that program are joining the service, and they would be like the kids we have over in Iraq right now. 109 letters. I would like for you to take those letters. But the bottom line to me is this. This program in Central Oregon is the number one program in the United States in 2002. It costs the same amount of money to incarcerate 7.5 young people in this state as it cost for us to run this program for an entire year, and we need that money. And the last thing and final thing, it's not a situation where school versus COTEP, and I think you'll probably be hearing about that. The bottom line to me is these young people, whether they graduate from high school that they're dropping out of or whether they graduate from our program is irrelevant to me. The bottom line is these students are graduating, they're going back into our societies, and they are being good public citizens. So with that in mind, I'm not here to plead or beg. I'm here to ask you to reason, because this is a great program and everyone benefits. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for the time, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Clifford. I'm also a member of the advisory board. I don't think there's any question that this is a valuable program. I don't think there's any question that it should be funded. I believe there is a subsequent referral of the Ways and Means Committee from this committee. I would hope that you would pass this bill out quickly and get it down there in the queue. I don't envy you the task of finding the dollars for the school fund or for any other means of funding this program. But I'll leave that to your tender mercies and urge you to approve this program, because it's a winner. There are a lot of winning programs that you're going to be faced with funding, but this is among the very best. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Do you have a quick question, Representative?
I do. My question is, why didn't we do this a long time ago? My question is, could we just get with the Department of Education in some format and set a date and work with them, because we pushed on this last session, you know, when we saw the successes of it, and we got the boss back there who certainly will speak to that and how hard, you know, we worked on it to talk to superintendents. But wouldn't you think that if we got together with Susan Castillo and the education department, I mean, what we're taking are dollars that are going to be spent anyway on dropouts that are going to drop out, so why don't we put those dollars to get them a better value for those dollars, save those kids, and save $100,000 a year in an Oregon Youth Authority?
Thank you.
I asked my question. That was it. I'd like an answer. Could we do
that? Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, as former chair of the House Education Committee, you guys have some very, very tough decisions to make. The schools use this program. This school, many of the students that come here are sent by the schools, by the counselors, by the principals, by those kind of people. And I know that the schools know the value of this program. Unfortunately, funding is a problem, and the decision is yours to make on how that money is split. If the schools had all the money they could use and could fund their programs, I'm sure they'd love to see this thing even expanded. But it's really a tough time. Mr. Chair, if I'd like to point out, we're very fortunate in Deschutes County to have Tom Clifford there. For those who may not have served with him, he was head of a legislative council here for over 20 years and very familiar with the building and has become a very active community member since he's come over there.
Great. Thank you.
If I can just answer your question, I think if I may speak on this again, I don't think it's a question of who we're competing with. I think it's a question of where the money being competed for. And I'll say it again, the bottom line is not the fact that the money is going one place. The bottom line to me is the kids are graduating, and those kids are coming from public schools where they have dropped out, and without this program, they wouldn't be going back to those schools, and they would stay dropouts. And in that respect, I hope that's one of the most important factors. And secondly, I wish they'd had this program when I was a kid, because it wouldn't have taken me quite as long to get where I am today, which isn't really that far, but I'm better off than I would have been. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3219. I can assure you that there are some other comments that are going to need to be made on this, and the bill will come back to us. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3114. Committee, I'm going to stay here and take the testimony. If you all need to take off and go back, go ahead. I'm going to pound through these other bills once we've taken the testimony on 3114.
Do you need a quorum, Mr. Chair?
Pardon?
Do you need a quorum?
Do I have to have a quorum here to
take questions?
Okay, but do I have to have a quorum to pound these others through?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you. I'm going to appoint myself and Representative Mabry, if he's staying with me, as a subcommittee on hear testimony. Thank you, committee, for your indulgence. Okay. Representative, thank you for your indulgence, and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce to you my constituent from Corvallis, who has brought this bill. This is Dr. Fred Decker. He's an OSU emeritus faculty. He was deputy assistant U.S. Secretary of Education for the Reagan administration. This bill came out of a situation in School District 509J, where the school board for Corvallis took action in early 2002 to minimize the access by students at school to information about the opportunities in all after-school activities. The reason, under federal law, the target organization, Boy Scouts of America, is one of the nationally chartered organizations that can't be treated any less favorably than other organizations in this regard. Why did the board target the Boy Scouts of America? Beginning in mid-2001, agitators began advocating expulsion of the Boy Scouts of America from use of school facilities and from presenting information about scouting to school students unless the Boy Scouts of America took a non-discrimination pledge. In late 2001, the board took action towards forming policy that would A, charge a penalty rental fee for use of school gyms for scout meetings, and prohibit any informational presentations about scouting to reach students for or at through the school. The U.S. Congress, meanwhile, had moved toward enactment of a bill which the President signed into law January 2002, allowing no federal funds to go to school districts that either, one, banned information about service in the armed forces to reach students, or, two, negatively discriminated against in-school information or facility usage by any of the nationally recognized patriotic organizations on a list which includes the Boy Scouts of America. This made it too expensive to carry out the intended attack on scouting in the schools. Instead, the board adopted a policy proposed by the superintendent that severely reduces access by students in the schools to information about any after-school learning activity other than those conducted under school district auspices. Specifically, no face-to-face contact is allowed in the schools by students of ages at which boys enter scouting. For them, only flyers marked to indicate non-sponsorship by school district 509J can get distributed for students to carry home. Since the school building and grounds amount to the public square for students, the loss of opportunity for personal response to student questions and break times in the school day represented a major reduction in the service to students seeking information about scouting or other non-classroom opportunities provided by community organizations supporting education. So this is a situation in Corvallis where the school district has moved to basically block the Boy Scouts from using facilities or make it very difficult for them. That's why we have brought this bill, Mr. Chair. We have a dash one amendment. I've spoken to John Marshall of the school district. They're willing to work with us on further amendments. They're interested in taking care of this situation and clarifying it. So I would like to give Fred Decker time now for his presentation.
Great, thank you. Dr. Decker, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Very briefly, enacting this House Bill 3114 should assure state-funded school districts will routinely cooperate with community-sponsored activities providing an environment of enthusiasm for learning achievement. Educators widely agree, and I'm sure that most parents fully understand, that the enthusiasm and the sponsorship indicated for learning achievement is very essential to making progress in school. So there's a two-way advantage, and schools should take advantage of anything that boosts the out-of-school environment of students so that they feel that what they're doing in school as well as what they're learning outside is important and is the way of life for them. As amended, the House Bill 3114 can affect a sensible relationship between school boards and sponsors of after-school learning activities for maximizing the diversity of choice and attainment of individual goals of these K-12 striving learners. I realize your time is shortened. There are a lot of other things that could be said. I have given some details in a one-page statement provided to the committee.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Decker. Do you have any questions, Representative? Okay. Before you... So really, the crux of the bill is to just make sure that that schools are allowing youth-oriented groups whatever access to the facilities, and that it be equal across all grounds in terms of what kind of rent they charge, if they're going to charge rent, and what kind of hours they're open or and that sort of thing. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and there's also a clause that says that if they deny access, then they would be denied the state monies from public education providers, and that is what is the case at the federal level. The federal funds are denied.
I guess I would call that an incentive.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, there's one item there, of course, that is easy to have it appear rather non-essential, but this face-to-face, no face-to-face contact really is a wet blanket. It's a stiff arm. It amounts to a wall of separation, if you will, a very negative wall of separation against the out-of-school activities, foisting on teachers the responsibility of simply handing out a flyer to take home doesn't guarantee that flyer gets home. Not if it carries with it an announcement on it, printed on it, or stamped on it that it's not that this activity is not sponsored by or officially conducted by the school district. It's the cordiality of welcome by the person, the leader, who personally represents and hands out to the student who asks for it or asks questions is very important. And I think that is a point that's made, that the no face-to-face contact shouldn't be the rule of things for all contact about the out-of-school activities.
Thank you, Dr. Decker, and Representative, and thank you for your indulgence this morning. I appreciate it. We have with us John Marshall and Chuck Bennett, who wanted to speak. Or do you not want to speak? Stand up here and speak.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and I spoke to Representative Close about some issues inside the proposed amendments relating to new federal requirements under No Child Left Behind, some student records issues, that is the release of identifiable information of students that's also dictated by some federal law. And we believe that we can sit down, put a group together, come up with some amendments that fit the bill before you in the context that will be workable, and we'd certainly be willing to put together a group to fix it.
Okay. If you're willing to put together a group to fix that, then let me ask you to go ahead and just coordinate that through Representative Close. And then but please keep in mind that we need to have any amendments by the evening of the 15th so that we can put it on the agenda for the 17th.
It shouldn't take very long, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, John. Appreciate that. With that, then, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3114. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3268. I'm going to close public... Was there anybody that wanted to speak on that bill? I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3268. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Memorial 2 and close a public hearing on House Memorial 2. Open a public hearing on House Memorial 3. Close a public hearing on House Memorial 3. Open a public hearing on House Memorial 4. Close a public hearing on House Memorial 4. Open a public hearing on House Memorial 5. Close a public hearing on House Memorial 5. Open a public hearing on House Memorial 6. Close a public hearing on House Memorial 6. Open a public hearing on House Memorial 7. Close the public hearing on House Memorial 7. Open a public hearing on House Memorial 8. Close a public hearing on House Memorial 8. With that, we have finished our business. Representative Mabry.
I maybe missed it. I didn't hear you tap 3237. Was that intentional? Or?
Actually, it was, but you know what? I'm going to go ahead and tap it anyway. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3237 and close a public hearing on House Bill 3237, and we have gotten everything else on the agenda. Is that correct? Patrick, thank you. With that, then, thank you. I believe that the proponent of that bill is actually going to try to work with the governor on an executive order to do it that way.
Part of my agenda. And so I noticed the number. So.
That's quite all right. Thank you very much. But we have basically saved it. So okay. Thank you for that. With that, we will stand adjourned.